Okay, so I think this is the last of the series, if I got it right. And I guess my last shiur then in Shomrei Shabbos, probably, at least for now. Okay, so tonight what I want to do is analyze at least some elements of the halachic methodology of Rav Gorin. Now, Rav Gorin is a very, very complicated figure to analyze at many different levels. He was the first chief rabbi of the IDF. He later became the chief rabbi of the State of Israel in the 70s, amidst the controversial Langer affair, in which he deemed two children to be not mamzerim, when much of the rabbinic world felt they were mamzerim. And there was a bit of controversy over the extent to which politics had influenced the choice of him being chief rabbi, as he had already indicated that one of the things he would do as chief rabbi was find a halachic way to permit the Langer children to marry. But what I want to do is try to analyze some of the points in his halachic methodology. Some of these I've given in other shiurim, some I have not. The first thing that I think comes out of much of his writing is what I would call Shlilat HaGola. And a second thing which we'll see is let's start with Shlilat HaGola. Right? One of the things that is evident in his thought is this notion that at some level he really did evaluate Israel to be qualitatively different, and existence in the land of Israel qualitatively different, and that didn't just, right? Some poskim just think that Israel is different, but therefore they don't, it doesn't apply negative things necessarily about Jewish life outside of Israel. But Rav Gorin was not really of that camp. I think some of his psak really does embrace a very ambitious thesis of Israel being fundamentally different, and therefore the Gola being a negative. Now, there's two ways in which I think this is evident. One is a small way, which I'll mention and then we'll come back to in a moment, which simply comes from the issue of names. Rav Gorin, when he first met Ben-Gurion, the meeting went well. He was interviewing to be the chief rabbi of the IDF before it was actually the IDF, but okay. And he says at the end of the meeting, Ben-Gurion said to him, on the way out, you know, drop the, what's this, Goronchik? Drop the chick. And he said they came into the meeting Goronchik. He left the meeting Goren. And that was it. Now, where did that come from? So for Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion was part of a secular version of Shlilat HaGola, of people who believed that to be Israeli meant to negate the experience of the Jews outside of Israel. And I gave you here the Wikipedia passage if you want to read it. I'm not going to go through it, but part of it, the source is over here. But part of Shlilat HaGola for Ben-Gurion was that Israelis should embrace Israeli names, and therefore he was born Green or Gruen, and he changed it to Ben-Gurion. And at some point he actually institutionalized this, in the bolded part, if you just look down in the history here, it writes that Ben-Gurion, in order to the Israeli Defense Force soldiers, wrote, "It is desirable that every commanding officer from squadron commander to chief of staff should change his surname, whether German, English, Slavic, French, or foreign in general, to a Hebrew surname, in order to be a role model for soldiers. The Israel Defense Forces must be Hebrew in spirit, vision, and in all internal and external expressions." A binding order of the same issue was issued to the officials of the state in 1950, and particularly to those who represented the state abroad. A committee for Hebrew names was established to supervise the implementation of the order, whose task was to assist and advise the choice of a Hebrew name. Right, so this was very symbolic for Ben-Gurion. I mean, there was a pamphlet they put out, it's mentioned here, by the Jewish Agency, giving people advice on how to change their names.
You remember, you're Amichai Harari, who's Ben-Gurion walked towards his father and said, "You should change your name from whatever it was to Harari." It was a European name that meant, I forget the name, something with an F.
Negative, and
what?
It was a negative name, or
it was just Mint Mountain.
Oh, it was Mint Mountain. Okay.
And he just told him.
So he said, change it to Harari.
That's it.
Okay, makes sense, right? Ben Gurion used to do this all the time, and he did it to Rav Goren, and that's why he went from Goronchik to Goren. But the truth is that he wasn't alone. There were rabbinic thinkers who thought this as well, and it seems like that Rav Goren was of this camp, though he doesn't actually write a tshuva on the topic.
Zandberg.
What?
Zandberg was the name.
Zandberg. Okay, I didn't know that Mid Mountain. I wouldn't have known. But okay. Now, where do they get this from? So I just gave you right one source, right? The probably the most famous of it. That the source number one here. That Rav Huna Amar B'Shem Bar Kapara B'Shvil Arba Dvarim Nigalu Yisrael Mitzrayim Shloshinu Et Shmam Ve'Et Lashonam Lo Amru Lashon Hara Lo Nimtzu B'Neim Echad Me'en Parutz Berva Lo Shanu Loshinu Et Shman Ruvain Shimon Nachten Ruvain V'Shimon Salkin Lo Yekarn Liyuda Rufa V'Lo LeRuvain Lulaini V'Lo LeYosef Listes V'Lo Ben Alexandri. The Jews, why did they get to go out of Mitzrayim, got out of Egypt? So the first thing was they didn't change their names. What does it mean they didn't change their names? The Gemara, so the Midrash gives examples. They, you know, they didn't, whatever. I don't know exactly why Yehuda would be Rufus, but whatever. They wouldn't change their name to non-Jewish names. And based on this, there's a big machlokas aposkim, which I won't get into, as to whether in fact there's a prohibition to use non-Jewish first names. The Maram Shik thinks that yes, it's a formal mitzvah, or a prohibition. It's an iser of b'chukos and lo seilechu. Most poskim assume that it's a midas chasidus. It's just a nice thing to do. Some poskim try to distinguish. The Avnei Yashveh says that it depends. It depends on whether your English name is simply a translation of a Hebrew name, right? So Jonathan would not be a problem because Jonathan is simply the standard transliteration of Yonatan, where the J, right, the Y becomes a J. But a name like Peter, right, which doesn't have a easy, you're laughing, I don't know what the Hebrew equivalent of Byron is either, I'm sorry, would be problematic. But some poskim, and I gave you here number 6 from Rav Shlomo Aviner, who was born, not Rav Shlomo Aviner, but probably not Rabbi either, was born Claude Langenauer, which is slightly less obviously Jewish than Shlomo Aviner. He writes a tshuva where he defends on halachic ground this notion of what's called ivrut, right? Hebraicization. He writes sheila ivrut shemish b'chaim ze rak davar shemutar lasod osh ze ra'uy v'tzarich v'chashuv kechilek mihashiva arza v'nituk mehagalut v'chulei. Is this just something permitted, or is it something that's proper or even obligatory as part of returning to Israel and separating from the diaspora? Im la sozo rafo pishashara achim lo ishanu et shema mishpacha v'imutar la sozo im haorim makbidim. Can you do it even if your siblings won't? So therefore you're splitting up the family. And can you do it even if your parents are opposed? And he writes, yes, yesh ma'ala lavarat et ha-shem. There is a value to Hebraicization of the name. Kadesh yulon ha-shem o Yehudim. So we should have Jewish names. V'yiduim divrei maram shik, shenosei shem goy over al yisrim, v'nator mishum b'chuko seyem. And we know the Maram Shik says that it was a biblical prohibition to use non-Jewish names. Sh'ne'amar v'avdil et chem v'na'amim liot li. She'ein ra'shem li damod v'lehem b'shum v'ofen. You can't be comparable to them in any way. Ach. Yesh makom ladun b'dvarav l'chalek im osa kem furash k'di l'amot l'am. Right, you could argue on this halachically. Are you doing it in order to imitate them? Osho se kach misiba acheret. But if you skip down a line, he says, al kol pani, right? No, you'll just keep go through. Marash dam kata b'feirosh l'gabay anusei Portugal, shishinu shmam yudi l'shem goy, shigam acharit shechazru b'tshuva mutar lem l'shem ha'shem goy l'ezit zorach rishmi k'ein gan elam midechazru l'imana. The Marash Dam said that some of the Muranos in Portugal, when they came back, they didn't. They used non-Jewish names. They, for official purposes, they can keep using their name because it's only a midat chasidut. Al kol panim misarim maram shik atzmo. Now you might have said, how do you know that it applies to last names? Right? Classically, last names are irrelevant. So he says, my smach, my support that it applies to last names is this apocryphal story, which I don't know whether it's true or not, but everyone tells it. The maram shik himself. When it was decreed by law that you had to take a last name, a family name, He took Shik, which just is an acronym for Jewish names are holy, right? Which is his right opposition to last names. Kedei latgish shenein lochem shem goy. Ha'olam midvarim elu shavana yish erech l'shem yudi v'l'shem goy. So therefore, there's a value to a Jewish name. He said, admittedly, I don't pass on the Maram Shik. It's not an obligation, but it's valuable. Even last names. He said, the fact that the siblings aren't changing their names, that's irrelevant. What about the parents? He said, even that I don't think matters. Kibbut Avim is limited and doesn't apply to things that don't benefit the parents directly. And therefore he says there's no obligation to listen to the parents. And therefore he suggests what you should do is you should make a hyphenated name. Right? A hyphenated name, like, I don't know, Rabbi Rakefet, right? Rakefet Rothkopf, right? So that you keep it, you make a more Israeli name, you keep the more European name. Maybe that'll make them happy, and by the next generation no one will care, and you'll just move straight to the Hebrew name. But what's the point here? Rabbi Avinir articulates a halachic vision in which Ben Gurion's spirit of Shlilat HaGolah through names is actually a halachic implication, and has halachic implications, and Rav Goren, though he never articulated it, seems to have been part of this. Now, that's a very small one. I like using that example. It's lighter than some of the other stuff. But I think that it fits with Rav Goren's bigger approach in life. And this is, source 7 is a much more extreme, is a much, much more extreme expression of this than the name one. I mean, this isn't a fascinating example. Here's the tshuva. Rav Goren, when he was chief rabbi, used to issue conversion I don't know what you'd call it. In Ishur after you got a conversion, right? A conversion license, I don't know, right? But it would say that the conversion license, the conversion only takes effect in Israel and not if the ger leaves and goes to Chutz Laretz. So in England, at some point, they got this document and they wrote to Rav Goren and said, "What is this? Right? This has got to be fake, right? You can't. This person must have made up this document. There's no such thing. Like, what are you talking about? Either the person's a Jew now or they're not. What do you mean you're a Jew if you stay in Israel and you're a non-Jew if you go to Chutz Laretz? Right now, as we'll see, Rav Goren says, no, that's actually what I said, right? And here we move from little things, right? Symbolic Shlilat HaGolah, to this being a shita in life. So if you look at 7, here's what he writes. Hayadut be'Anglia, so erid bizman ha'acharon. There's been a storm going on in England. Why? Misaviv levaya ekronit. Around a fundamental problem. B'davar zeyutam yudim shel yaladim. About the Jewishness of certain children. She'imam hitgairam b'fnei beidin rabbani ba'aretz. The mother had converted by in front of a rabbinical court in Israel. V'asher p'tu'udat ha'giyur shela'em katuv l'tu'udah zeh in tokef b'chol. And on it, it writes that this conversion is not enforced in, has no force in Chutz Laretz. Siv zeh shuchnas al yidei kotev ma'amar zeh b'tu'udat ha'giyur shela'em ba'aretz. The person who wrote this clause, me'orer v'kuach so'er. This created a fight, a storm. Because everyone's asking us, what is this halachic? Where did you get this halachic argument? What type of limitation is this? And since this person is functioning right, on behalf of the rabbinate, we turn to me to explain why is this here? And it was on every conversion document under my auspices as chief rabbi. So he writes, he said, if you look through, Rav Goren, very much like making broad statements about the Yerushalmi, this was also part of his Torat Eretz Yisrael move, was that he drew very much on Yerushalmi, not just Bavli. And he also had an encyclopedic grasp of everything. So he could make statements like this. So he said, if you look through all of Bavli, you'll find that the Bavli has negative things to say about conversion. Right? Kashin Gerim Yisrael Kisapachat, right? Jews, conversions are like to the Jewish people, like a scab, right? Not such positive things to say about conversion. The Yerushalmi, he claims, does not have this negativity. So he says, is this a machlokes Bavli Yerushalmi? You could have just said it's a machlokes Bavli Yerushalmi. It's in fact a machlokes, it seems to be a machlokes in the Gemara itself. There are different voices in the Gemara. But Rav Goren suggests that no, it's a machlokes Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz. Why? He says, a yachas ashlish lisha Talmud Bavli ligiyur ligeirim noveya mitnayim akom bo megairim. The negative approach of the Babylonian Talmud, of those in Bavel, to converts, flows from the conditions where they were converting. Whether it be Bavel or anywhere else in the diaspora, or most of them were not Jewish. What are you going to do? The one who's going to convert is still going to stay with his non-Jewish family. And there's a concern that the convert, male or female, or their children, right, second generation, they're not going to be split from their non-Jewish family. They're still going to go for Christmas, they're still going to go, whatever, right? Michageihem, veideihem, pulchanam, their holidays, their worship, yamshichu lichyot, kivnei mishpachat kovim vavim, they'll continue to be a loving family. Now, to be fair, Rav Moshe Feinstein writes that at some level, I don't know about celebrating, I would assume he didn't say this about celebrating Christmas, but the second half of it, that a convert shouldn't shun his family. Rav Moshe has a tshuva. He was asked, does a convert have to be mechabed his parents? And he says, look, if the parents were supportive in the conversion, you know, it is the right thing to do to continue to have a relationship and show respect. They were supportive of it. Okay, maybe, yeah, Gersha, Nidgayar, Katinok, Shanolad, I mean, maybe technically they're not his parents, but if they were supportive through the process, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. See, you know, Anglo-Poskim will actually say, you know, it's not such a bad thing that they continue to have a relationship with their non-Jewish family. You know, you have to figure out the right way of navigating these things. But Rav Goren doesn't like this at all. Because he says they're going to end up part of the same family. The children will grow up in a non-Jewish culture and atmosphere. And therefore, conversion there isn't really trustworthy. But if you convert in Israel, where most of those living there were Jews, even after the Churban, which is what the Yerushalmi says, that most of Israel was Jewish, Hager v'gam yiladav yit'aru b'yehudim, what will happen? Someone will convert, and slowly but surely they will split, or maybe not slowly but surely, they will just split from their non-Jewish family, and they will be part of the Jewish culture. Their children won't even remember. They won't have any idea that their parents were converts. Kanagi, you're amin. So here it's trustworthy. It's more certain. Lachain, yachasu shel Talmud Bavli shlilig legiur v'shal Yerushalmi chayuvi, and therefore the Bavli is negative about conversion. The Yerushalmi is positive. Ayidei avchana zo efshar lavin et abraidim zechad geirim chaviva eretz Yisrael shemachsheret ageirim. Based on this, you can understand a puzzling statement in Masechet Geirim, which is one of the Masechtot Ketanot, which says that Eretz Yisrael is beloved because it purifies converts. Ki be'eretz Yisrael yeshna tikva v'kiyum sikui tov shegerim yinatku atzmam me'avram u'mimishpachtam. Because there's hope and a good chance that converts will cut themselves off from their past and their family v'chiyu ya'kan ki'yudim l'chol davar, and live here as Jews in every sense of the word. Ayusod avchana brura zo b'ina Talmud Bavli Yerushalmi. And based on this distinction between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, hichladnu bizmano b'leiv kaveh le'ano levakashar gyura murubad ba'aretz. Therefore, we decided with a heavy heart to respond to the needs of conversion in Israel. After a year of learning Torah, and accepting mitzvot, when we were convinced they plan on living in Israel and continuing there. If not, then all of the Bavli's curses on conversions, that they're scabs and that they cause Mashiach to come later, is all true. I should say this because I'm on record, and every time you give a shiur like this, someone will listen and say, I'm endorsing this position. I'm not endorsing this position, right? I'm just saying what the position is. But if we continue, he says, Kedela te tokev lachatot elos usaf bitoch du dara giyor asyak shenlato da tokev bechol kishashneat omim gam yachad. And therefore, to institutionalize this into law, I wrote in the Tudot Geyor that they only have effect in Israel. Basher le Geyor, it should be London. So therefore, this convert in London. Nechonon ena yidiot. If what I've heard is true, harehi hafrad kol avtachot shel lanu. She nullified, she violated all the promises she made to us. V'chilat ha-shvua she-nishba l'shmor al mitzvot ha-Torah li-shar b'aretz. She violated her two promises, to keep the Torah and to stay in Israel. Kmo chin yotzia et tudat ha-giyur b'mirma b'asher rima halacha yadut sh'mikoch ha-giratanu. And she took out this tudat giyur deceptively. He nisal l'kohen ha-surah alav, he nisayit b'tekez reformi, right? She ended up marrying a Kohen in a reform ceremony. Vihi Azvad Aretz Man Katzal Achar Giyur, and left the land, the Israel immediately, right after her conversion. How can she expect the privileges of being a Jew when she managed to get her conversion document without being honest? And therefore, that clause that we wrote is correct and obligatory and binding. From the perspective of halacha, nationalism, and personal integrity. Right? So you see that what starts as this symbolic name thing, where I'm just conjecturing, right? I'm just guessing that Rav Goren, like Rav Avinair, you know, Rav Goren wasn't the type of person to be afraid of anybody, right? He got into many fights with people over his years, starting with, you know, if you read his autobiography, you'll see that starting when he was a very young child, right? He says when he was 12 in Hebron, he was younger than everybody else by a good, you know, almost two decades, right? At least a decade plus. He said at some point, right, he'd been told by the Rosh Hashiva that he should try to learn, I think he said, 7 blot a day, so that he would finish Shas every year. He started with that, decided it wasn't a good idea, moved to 24 blot a day with Gemara Rashi Tosfos. So he said he used to sit there when he was 12 reading Gemara like, you know, you read the newspaper, right? He just flipped the pages. And all the older guys who were a good decade plus older than him used to assume that he was making it up. So what he did once was he went to the bathroom and, you know, they came and someone played a trick on him and turned the, you know, the pages, assuming he wouldn't notice. And he got back and he was so angry that anyone would challenge, right, his authenticity, that he got up and he said, I will not forgive the person who did this unless the person comes now and admits it and tests me and says, I think he said it was like tells me like the first word in Tosfos, and I'll say the rest of the Gemara, the Amud Gemara Rashi Tosfos Baal Peh for him, and right, and then he carried out this test on Yevamos or whatever it was, right, and he, you know, that was the way he won his cover. He wasn't someone to be scared of anybody, neither was Ben Gurion, but still, right. The fact that he gave in to Ben-Gurion, I assume, is because he actually identified with it, right? Ben-Gurion's notion of Shlilat HaGola, which he represented in sort of these political realms, right? When you see Rav Goren's tshuva, a tshuva like this, where he says, yeah, right, conversion, it's not just me, right? Rav Goren doesn't just assume that Shlilat HaGola is new, right? He says, the machlok is Bavli Yerushalmi, about whether conversion is a good thing or a bad thing, is not a machlokes. Those who live in Golos know that being Jewish is hard. Converting to Judaism is near impossible because the culture is saturated with non-Jewishness. You'll be part of your non-Jewish family. There's nothing you can do. You come to Israel, magic. Right? You will leave their family. Right? People suddenly don't care about their parents, their siblings. Right? Gershon. Right? It's amazing. Right? He doesn't just say this as a formal statement. Right? He assumes this culturally. He assumes it halachically, psychologically. Right? You see his words. Right? He says, "I assume this hilchati." Right? Halachically, nationalistically, and in terms of personal integrity. Right? Meaning, he assumes that this is at every level. If you're going to convert in Israel, you've got to commit to staying there, because that's the only place that makes sense. And he's willing to go far enough, so far as to say the person is not Jewish. That the conversion in Israel can be... Right, this is not... After it was done! Right, after it was done, there's not even a bittul, right? He invents this category called conditional geiros on living in Israel. Right, Rav Goren... Right, when I say that Rav Goren, one of the things in his psak is shlilat ha-golah, right, is that he negates the value or possibility of true Jewish existence in Israel, right? I mean it, right? He has some serious halachic claims that go in that direction. So that, I think, is the first type of methodological assumption that he goes in with. And in this case, it is a particularly controversial one and hard to swallow. But, on the other hand, as you see in Rav Goren, right, he was challenged about it. This wasn't just a theoretical paper, right? There are different types of tshuva. Right? Sometimes you write a tshuva to explain yourself. Sometimes someone actually challenges you and you're just standing up for it. Right? So here, he's not just explaining it. Right? He's doing this in response to someone said, "You're out of your mind." And he says, "No, I'm not." Right? This is exactly what I think. This is the way it is.
Sure, it was accepted.
Did I say it was accepted? I didn't say it was accepted. But you will quote it. You will hear it quoted. You will hear people, not quite the way he's saying it, but you will hear people saying a toned down version. Right? Which is, we can have lower standards of conversion in Israel, because even if someone isn't totally committed to halacha, right,
they're still in Israel,
and they're still living Jewishly, right? And they'll point to Rav Goren's extreme view and say, okay, we're not saying that. We're not saying that the conversion won't work the second he crosses the border, but we are saying that conversion is different, right? So you will see, right, hints of this. Now, the other thing the name thing hints at is that Rav Goren does consistently take symbolism very seriously. And this is something in his life that is very important in very striking ways. The best story about it is when a man came to Rav Goren and said, "I had a dream." Right? He came to him with this nice, beautiful, big shofar. And he said, and Rav Goren's like, what is this big shofar? And he says, "I had a dream that I was supposed to make this big, beautiful shofar and give it to you, to Rav Goren, so that you could go and blow it on the top of Har Sinai." And therefore, in 1956, during the war with Sinai, Rav Goren got to the mountain that he believed was Har Sinai, Jebel Musa. And in the middle of the war, right, against everybody's advice, climbed up to the top of the mountain and took this shofar with him and blew the shofar, right? This was just what he did. He just did these things. It also led the famous pictures in 1967 weren't accidental. Right? It wasn't like he happened to carry a shofar with him. Like, Rav Goren was very symbolic. He thought that the right thing to do was for the rabbi to go in the front, and he said, "I want to be there first so I can blow a shofar, because that is what we're supposed to do. The rabbi is supposed to be there. There's supposed to be a nationalist, right, religious presence first when we get to the Kotel." Right? He was very into symbolism, into nationalistic symbolism. This was his personality. I don't know if that's a psak thing, but it's definitely a personality thing. So that's one element of his psak. The second one, which at this point I think I've talked about in like 15 different shirim, so I will run through it quickly, but it is definitely something that is clear in his psak throughout, is his conviction of two things. One is the importance of unity, and two is the possibility of creating a Jewish state al pi halacha. Now, you would think that those are distinct. They are, but they overlap in the next incident. Very quickly, 1948, July 31st, there was a two religious cooks refused to cook on Shabbos. Their officer who was anti-religious, convicted them for insubordination, and in an act of anti-religious vindictiveness, shaved their heads, including their peyos, which obviously after the Holocaust had a lot of symbolism. There were it caused an uproar. Rav Maimon quit, resigned from being the head of the Sar HaDatot, the religious affairs minister, and said that such a government cannot be a Jewish government. This is not a Jewish army. What is this? Right. I noted that when the cooks appealed their sentence and revenge, they extended the sentence to 3 months. There were riots in response. Right, rallies in Bnei Brak, in Ramat Gan, in Tel Aviv. Ben Gurion, sensing disaster, said, "Okay, we're going to set up." He issued a public statement through Yaakov Dori, who was the staff major general, that we are going to create an Israeli army rabbinate, and the army rabbinate will make sure that issues like this don't happen. We're going to set standards for religious Jews in the army. Now, Rav Goren commemorates this and says that when they had the meeting where they were trying to think of policy, there were two positions at the meeting of how to solve the problem. One was everybody's position, and the other was just him and Ben-Gurion on the other side. The position of almost everybody there was the only way to solve this problem is to have secular units and religious units, and never the twain shall meet. Right? He notes here from Aaron Sisling of Mapam, on the secular side, he said he was ready to put all the religious soldiers in separate companies, platoons, battalions, and divisions, give them everything they wanted, let them pray all day, every day, all week long, let them eat chulin all week long, do whatever they wanted, on the condition that they would let the non-religious soldiers do whatever they wanted. Right? That was the secular position. We don't want you, go away, you can do what you want, just leave us alone. And the religious party said the same thing. Right? Let us keep Shabbos, Kashrus, put us in our own units, we don't want it, like, Shalom al Yisrael. And Rav Goren said, right, he got up and he yelled at them. And he said, "You're out of your minds." And he says, I gave you in bold. He said, "What would the ramifications be of the religious soldiers being segregated in religious units? The result would be that the entire army wouldn't observe religious precepts, wouldn't eat kosher food, wouldn't observe Shabbat and holidays, wouldn't have any synagogues. Only the few special units that would be defined as religious would have strictly kosher food, observe all the Shabbat laws, and have synagogues. Now that we'd run the right to establish our own state, now that we'd built the IDF, we had the right to demand that the entire army behave like a Jewish army." He said to them, "Are you out of your mind?" And then he, right, when he commemorates this moment, you remember this moment in a YouTube clip I gave you, he says that it didn't even make sense. He said, you can't have two armies. Second of all, you should divide soldiers by skill in fighting, not their religious outlook. And he said that how was the issue decided? The issue decided by Ben-Gurion, who came in and said, "Yesh lanu am echad, tzava echad, medina echad, lo yitachen lefatzel et hatzava lefi hashkafot." Right? We have one nation, one army, one state. We can't split the army based on outlook. And that was what happened, and that's how the army became one. But in this decision, you see some of the elements of Rugoran's psak, which are, first of all, the importance of unity. Which was a big deal in his psak. But more importantly for his psak is, so again, the symbolic thing, the nationalist conviction, you see that expressed here. Right? Part of the reason he made this decision is because he believed that it's important that the state, right, the arms of the state be halachic, right? Have a Jewish identity. And he said, if you allow religious and non-religious Jews to separate, then the state as a whole will not have a Jewish identity, right? Not just the Kirov issue, right? That you'll force people to keep more Shabbos and Kashrus. But also, it won't have a Jewish halachic identity. And for him, that was very important. It was very important that, the state have a Jewish halachic identity. But it's more than that. Because here's the problem. Sometimes I give shir just on this, but I'm going to try not to get caught up on it. But here's the problem. If you have religious and non-religious units, so then how do you deal with halachic questions on Shabbos? L'chumrah. Because you know there are secular units that are going to do whatever they want, whether or not it's Shabbos. So therefore you can be machmir in every single position for the religious units. Why not? Right? Just say the religious units will work 6 days a week, right? Barring a straight out war or something. And the non-religious units will do whatever they want, and maybe they don't care about Shabbos, and we'll move on with our lives. The second you say that because of unity, or because of the importance of having a Jewish halachic identity to the state, we can't split. So then you have to come up with a way for an army that's going to keep Shabbos and keep Kashrus to function on Shabbos. And that requires, and this moves us to the next element of his psak, the importance of flexibility. Right, Rav Goren, right, some poskim are known as Mikilim, but very few will articulate the importance to their own psak that Kula has. But Rav Goren was quite articulate about it. In number 13, he said as follows. This was a speech. He said, "Bedor zeh, anu skukim legdolei Torah v'halacha shetiyeh lahem gisha mamlachtit lebayot." We need poskim who will have a nationalist orientation to solving problems, right? As I just said, right? No, problem one that you already see in his speech. But he tells you that this is not just a political statement. This is a halachic one. When you poskin shailas, it needs to be with a nationalistic tinge. V'yachas chiyuvi l'mifnei yistori b'am yudi shechal makamat medina, and you need a positive perspective on the historical turn of the state. Now, what does that mean? Right. So point one is you need a nationalist perspective. What does that mean? So he tells you, the eternity of Torah is found in the range of possibilities that are open to those who keep halacha, and those who study and investigate halacha. The Yerushalmi says that ilu nitna Torah chatucha lo hayta leregel amida. If the Torah had been given straight, had been given clear cut, had been given as a code, it couldn't stand. Because the Torah could then not have been expounded in 49 ways for leniency and stringency. Klomar ilu nitna Torah kfu'a kemo kod. Meaning, if the Torah had been given, set as a code, kach ta'aseh, v'kach lo ta'aseh, do this and don't do that. Lo hayta efsharut la'amod al haraglayim, v'chiyot opiyah, we couldn't stand or survive. Ela nitna b'tzura gmisha, was given in a flexible way, where there are always multiple possibilities, mem tet panim tameh, mem tet panim tahor, 49 ways to make it pure, and 49 ways to make it impure, mem tet panim chaya, mem tet panim zakai, 49 ways to declare someone liable, 49 ways to declare them not liable. B'chol dor v'ador yish chidushim shal dor zeh b'torah, every generation has their novelties, aval kol zeh v'rag m'sker na'torah, m'sker na'alacha, within the framework of Torah and halacha. So Rav Goren tells you two things simultaneously. Right? What does it mean to be a good posek for Rav Goren? One, to recognize the importance of the Jewish state and to poskin from a nationalist perspective, meaning poskining towards statehood. And two, as the army case proves, in order to do that successfully, meaning in order to say we're going to have a Jewish army that follows halacha in some way, shape, or form, that requires flexibility. That requires the ability to be makil. That requires creativity, the ability to find the room in halacha to make the difficult possible. So, if we're now following, right, Rav Goren, so we first thing he said is that he cares about symbolism and defines the Jewish experience fundamentally different in Israel as in Chutz La'aretz, Shlilat HaGola. And that expressed itself in his striking psak in Geirus. Right? That you can have Geirus that only is good in Israel and not in Chutz La'aretz because the Jewish life in Israel is fundamentally different. But then you see, if you take that a half a step further, right, it's not just Shlilat HaGola, right? It's a positive embrace of the importance of statehood. And he tells you that, therefore, to be a good posek means to paskin with an eye towards making statehood possible for everybody, not just for religious Jews, but for everybody. And then he takes it a half step further, which is, but statehood is hard. The shilas that come up in a state, and you know, over the last few years, we've talked about a lot of them. How do you have police on Shabbos in Israel? How do you have an army in Israel on Shabbos? How do you deal with hospitals on Shabbos? Requires flexibility and kula. Right? And you see that Rav Goren, right, he was radical, but there's a internal consistent, right? There's an internal coherence to the trajectory of his thought and the types of decisions he makes. So to give another one, on which points in both of these directions, both his nationalist element and his kula approach, and how they're often melt and they're often intertwined. I gave you in 15. This is Rav Goren's very surprising leniency on autopsies. Traditionally, the psak of the Noda Behuda, which had become quite dominant in post-Gim, was that you're not allowed to do autopsies for medical knowledge on Jewish bodies, unless it's going to save somebody's life right now, right? Meaning, if two people, right, seem to have the same disease, and one of them dies, and to figure out what the other one has, you need to do an autopsy to save the other person. What Noda Behuda calls chol lefaneinu and chol befaneinu, another sick person in front of us, you're allowed to do it. But for theoretical medical knowledge, the Noda Behuda says you can't do it. I don't want to get into that sugya now, but Rav Goren disagrees. Why he disagrees, I didn't give you the whole tshuva, but I gave you part of it. And this is what he writes in Torah Refuah. He says as follows. He said, look, the Noda Behuda was fine writing about France. He didn't live in France. He was writing about France, though. It's fine if you're writing in Galut. Because what's the worst that will happen? So you won't do this autopsy on this Jewish body. But what happens when you make that decision in Israel as a policy? There'll be no medical schools in Israel. Right? Medicine will not really advance in Israel, or you'll have to find non-Jewish bodies, which has its own problems, right? Which has its own sort of either halachic problems or political problems, right? Meaning, it's right. There are problems with that, right? Rav Uziel assumed there was a halachic problem because he assumed that Nivul HaMeis applies to Jews and non-Jews, and therefore didn't distinguish between Jews and non-Jews. He also found room for Kula even to do autopsies on Jews, but that's for Rav Uziel. You can take the Rav Kook position, and yes, there's a difference between Jews and non-Jews, but you know, Rav Kook in his Tshuva on autopsies says, well, the reason that you can do autopsies on non-Jews and not Jews is because non-Jewish bodies are not holy, and Jewish bodies are holy. And then he has this amazing statement where he says, and tell this to non-Jews, and they won't be offended. Because he'll just explain to them, we're holy, they're not. Why could that possibly be offensive? Right? That's actually what he says in his Tshuva, right? There's PR issues in a tshuva like that. But Rav Goren took a different approach. And he says as follows. V'hine, binogel chlal gadol b'ilchot pikuach nefesh. This is 15. With regard to the most important rule of pikuach nefesh, I gave you a translation also just because it was easy to find online. He said, shekavu shtei sintarot azav. Halohem anod yudu v'chad tam tofer. So nekrab pikuach nefesh el kasher acholu l'faneinu v'lo kasher alulah litorer ba'atid v'ayat. Right? He said the majority psak follows the two golden pipes, who say that something is only called saving a life if the person we're saving is here, but not because of some theoretical future ability to save lives. He said, look, this is the axis upon which this question turns. And it seems that we should say, she'ein kocho shekol ze yafeh. That's good for the Noda Behuda and Chasam Sofer. Why? Because they were responsible for the health of the whole nation. Right? They were poskening for a minority community in a majority land where science and medicine would develop with or without them. But here in Israel, we want medical schools in Israel. Kasher Medina v'am Achrayim. The Maracha Ratzuf Shel Rofim B'Yisrael, ולבריאות העם המתגורר במדינה, ואנו יודעים מראש שבעוד מספר שנים נצטרך מספר כזה וכזה שרופאים בעלי רמה גבוהה כדי שנוכל להבטיח את בריאות העם. ואם לא נקיים את בתי הספר לרפואה, נשאר לרוב רפואה מדינה. Said, in our case, when the state and the nation are responsible for the continuity of medical service in Israel, for the health of the people living in the country, and we know from the outset that in another few years we'll need a certain number of doctors of high caliber in order to ensure the health of the people. And if we do not maintain medical schools, the country will be left without doctors. And that's what he continues. Baruch Hashem should lean into Achmeitim, but they say for the fallen, Chalot, Tzimim, Rofim, Rim, Lishmam. Says Zanikra Cholesh Lefaneinu. Israel is definitionally Cholesh Lefaneinu, because you have to look at it from a nationalist perspective, from a national vantage point. Me'achar shemidina Yehudit Achrayit LeBriyut HaOluchzia VeChayevet LeTachnin HaShirut Yimshala LeTzvach Aroch. Because the state, the Jewish state, is responsible for the health of the population, must plan its services in the long run, in the long term. So Rav Goren tells you know why he thinks it's mutter? Because he said, look, the Noah de Behuda Chsam Sofer, who tell you Chol Lefaneinu, that tell you you need there to be an actual Pikuach Nefesh now, here, another sick person, same disease. That's great in a minority population. But Israel is a state, is a nation. And here the question isn't, are you going to save one life? It's, how do we create a functioning medical system? And the answer is medical schools. And don't tell me, go to Chutz Laretz, right? Go use non-Jews. Because it won't work. Because what are you going to do? So you're going to send the best doctors all abroad? We already do that. It's not great, right? Israel, as it is too small to allow people to do specialties, right? Specialty residencies in Israel. They have to go abroad. And many of them do stay in Israel. Right, stay out of Israel. That's the reality. It's a small country. It's hard. But Kal Vachomer, if we said you can't do any autopsies, which at least in the time of Goren, right now already the technology is moving and many hospitals are moving away from autopsies because we can do it with, you know, computers, we can do simulations and all types of fancy things, which is better from every perspective. Fine. But the reality was in his time that you needed to do autopsies, you needed to do dissections, you needed bodies, you needed cadavers. And here again, Rav Goren invokes his two principal rules. Mediniyut, right? Medina, right? A nationalistic perspective, a nation-oriented perspective, and kula, right? He said those two go together, right? We need a posek to say, establishing a national healthcare system, doctors, medical schools, is a halachic value, point one. And we need a posek who doesn't just say that in theory, but is willing to come up with kulot, is willing to be flexible, to see the flexibility in halacha, to make that a possibility. Again, I'll say this again into the recorder for that one person who's listening and will send me the angry email. I'm not endorsing it necessarily. This was a big machlokes. Everything here was machlokes. Rav Goren was prone to machlokes. But if you're analyzing his methodology, you see that there is a shita, right? There is a coherence to his position, right? That carries out through his psak and through his life, right? Through the narratives, the anecdotes in his life, and through the psak. Now, this leads to his most infamous or famous or whatever you want, but most well-known L'tov U'L'ra psak, which is the Langer affair, which I mentioned at the beginning. Again, the Langer affair, well, I just gave you a summary here, right? This is an article from Elie Fischer called The Langer Affair, the case that shook the halachic world. And here's his description, because getting into all the details is a bit complicated, but let's read it. The greatest threat to rabbinic control... No, okay, I'll just put the thesis out there for a moment. Elie Fischer's thesis in general is that, and it's, you know, it seems to bear itself out in the sources we've already seen, is that Rav Goren had a tendency towards poskening in ways that were... I don't want to say politically expedient, because that comes off wrong, but that would be politically acceptable, because of his conviction of the two things we just said. right? That he was convinced that halacha could survive in a state, and two, that required the ability to be makil. And he knew that if the rabbinate couldn't do that, right? He said the reason he got along with Ben Gurion, and I gave you in the link above, and Ben Gurion said the reason he had so much respect for Rav Goren was that he knew that halacha didn't always apply, or what Rav Goren would call you could be flexible in halacha.
What's the video above that you?
It's a retrospective they were giving an award. I put a link. On it's a number 10, right? Number 10. They were giving an award to Rav Goren, like towards the end of his life, and Ben Gurion was speaking about it. So they asked, it was an interview. They interviewed him. Why did you? You know, they were talking about their relationship, and they go through some of these issues. So one of the things that for Goren was really important was that you have a powerful chief rabbinate. But he knew that if the chief rabbinate wasn't flexible and the chief rabbinate didn't do what he felt it should do, which is paskin in such a way as to make halacha possible in the state, then the state would strip the rabbinate of its powers and you take a step backwards in terms of nationalist psak. And therefore, as Goren himself tells you, he had a tendency towards kula. The problem was that sometimes Poskim felt that Rav Goren, in his zeal to do this, right, even if you agree with him at some level, in his zeal to do this, some Poskim felt he went too far, as they did in the Langer affair. But you can't talk about Rav Goren without at least mentioning it. So this is, I gave you the summary in 17. The greatest threat to rabbinic control over personal status issues since the Stout's fainting was undoubtedly the brother and sister controversy. The siblings Chanoch and Miriam Langer were born to a woman who had left her first husband without a Jewish divorce. The children of such a union are mamzerim, halachically, and thus forbidden to marry Jews. Over several years, various state rabbinical courts confirmed that the Langers are mamzerim and could not marry. Finally, at the highest rabbinical court of appeals, rabbis Yosef Shalom Eliashiv, Avadi Yosef, and Shol Yisraeli, leading rabbinic figures in the Haredi, Sephardic, and religious Zionist camps respectively, upheld the ruling. Right? So this was, Lechumra was across the board. Haredi world, Datilumi world, Ashkenazi world, Sephardi world, everybody. Understandably, it was unconscionable to many Israelis that two Jewish citizens who had served in the IDF would not be permitted to marry. In the ensuing outrage, Defense Minister Dayan threatened to institute civil marriage if a halachic solution was not found, and one Knesset faction even proposed such a law, precipitating a coalition crisis. Senior politicians up to Prime Minister Golda Meir pressured the rabbis for a resolution. Rav Goren, then Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, entered the fray by proposing a resolution. The mother's first husband, a convert, was not really Jewish. The first marriage is not recognized by halacha, and the children were not born out of wedlock. He supported his contention with two arguments. There was no documentary evidence the first husband had converted, and even if he had undergone the conversion procedure, his lack of subsequent observance rendered the procedure meaningless. He presented his proposal to Sephardic Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Nissim, but it did not result in a review of the case. No matter, the terms of the incumbent Chief Rabbi were about to expire. Though the election procedures heavily favored the incumbent religious affairs minister Zerach Warhaftig, a proponent of Rav Goren's candidacy, altered the makeup of the voting body to ensure that Rav Goren was elected Ashkenazic chief rabbi. Within a month, Rav Goren permitted the Langers to wed their fiancés. His ruling was not immediately published, and though he claimed that 9 other rabbis signed onto his permit, their names were not released, ostensibly to protect them. The circumstances looked suspicious. It seemed that Rav Goren had worked out a deal. The election rules would be changed to ensure that he'd be made chief rabbi and he would resolve the Langer case. There was no reason to doubt the insincerity of Rav Goren's belief that he found a solution to the case, to suspect that he subverted halacha to political expedience or to call his rabbinic bona fides into question. Right? So, people accused Rav Goren at this point of political expedience. But if you know Rav Goren's psak, right, even just from the taste we've had tonight, there's no particular reason to think that Rav Goren wasn't being honest. Rav Goren felt to be a good posek in the 20th century in Israel meant to look for creative ways of being makil, especially when it was necessary to allow the state to continue to have a Jewish national flavor. And since under this question you had these two Israeli citizens who wanted to get married, who Poskim had said were mamzerim, and this was precipitating a crisis where the result would have been that the state would have removed the requirement of halachic marriage in the state as a whole. Right? The two things that Rav Goren cared about most in Psak, namely that you need to poskin towards creating a halachic state, and two, in service of that, you should be makil, they came together. Now, you can argue he was right, you can argue he was wrong. But as Elie Fischer notes, there's no particular reason to take the criticism of Rav Gorin's critic seriously, who said that he was just doing to become chief rabbi. At every stage in his life, he was very articulate about the fact that those were the two things that drove him. You may think he made a mistake, but it actually fits with his worldview quite well. So if we summarize what we've seen, right, Rav Gorin had a tendency towards valuing symbolism, towards Shlilat HaGola, right, of viewing existence in Israel as fundamentally different and better, explicitly arguing, therefore, that we should paskin in such ways that halacha could be kept in the state as a whole for all Jews, but recognizing the difficulty that would cause, he therefore pushed towards kula to make it possible. We saw the example from medical schools where he allowed autopsies by redefining chol lefaneinu in a national context. And in perhaps his most controversial psak in the Langer affair, for all the criticism he got, the fact that he found a creative way to prevent power being stripped from the rabbinate, to prevent civil marriage, which he saw as an affront to the religiosity of the state, from being instituted, that he found a kula to allow them to get married, right? It fits perfectly with the two things that he tells you drove his halachic psak. And that, I think, those elements, I think, together are a fair presentation of much of what is unique about his psak. Now, there are other things that come up. We mentioned one in passing, which is that part of his belief that Eretz Yisrael was unique was his reliance on Yerushalmi heavily, as opposed to Bavli, as opposed to using Bavli exclusively. Right? He used Bavli, obviously, but as opposed to Bavli exclusively. Part of it also was his use of Tanakh and other Jewish historical sources. And the last example, therefore, I'll give is his psak, another super controversial psak, was his position to encourage soldiers to commit suicide rather than be captured because of the Chilul Hashem. His proof were two. One was the fact that Shaul seems to have committed suicide to prevent him being captured and humiliated in his death, which would have demoralized the Jewish people. And two is the story of Masada as told by Josephus. But besides that psak being quite controversial, it also indicates many of the things we've talked about. His reliance on different sources, especially ones that to him were more classically nationalistic, looking back towards Tanakh, right, the period of the kings. Looking at Josephus, right? Looking at Jewish history in Israel, right? The valiant Jewish history to influence his psak itself. His conviction of creativity and flexibility in psak for things that was necessary. And what you take is that yes, Rav Gorin was in many ways a controversial personality, but it's hard to deny that he had a very strong, coherent view of what psak should do and what a post-egg should be. I mean, that at least is something that's worth analyzing. And even if you disagree with the extent he took it sometimes, his convictions and the way he tried to carry them out should be an inspiration to other post-egg. So that is at least a little bit of the methodology of Rav Gorin. And